Okay. Very good. So today we will continue our explorations of the idea CFT duality, and in particular of the study of local operators. But before, I would like to make sure that there is no confusion concerning what we discussed yesterday, because I felt like at some point I did a conceptual jump that maybe was not appreciated by everyone. So let me emphasize what we did. Let me repeat what we did. So we start with a four-point function. And what we did is we took the OP of two operators. We sent O1 into O2. When you send O1 into O2, you get some OP coefficients. I recommend that you just follow and then try to copy later. Again, as usual, I will not erase whatever I write before the class starts, of course. So you take the OP between O1 and O2, and what do you get? Well, you get a bunch of OP coefficients, B, that we saw were totally fixed by conformal symmetry. And then these operators, when you take the OP, you get all possible primaries k and all the descendants. And the B for the primary is fixed relative to the B for descendants, which are the ones which have this index mu. And all you have to do is you fix these guys, you take derivatives of the three-point function of the operator that you obtain when you take together O1 and O2. Now, there was one step that I made in the lecture without calling attention to it, only at the end I said, which is, when you take O1 into O2, it doesn't need to go into a third operator, which is a scalar. As I said at the end, in general, when you have two operators which are scalars according to the conformal group, they can fuse and they can give, in general, a symmetric traceless tensor, which will be a primary in principle of spin L. So when we sum over primaries, this sum over K means a sum over primaries that have some dimension delta and some spin L. And the scalar case is this case when L is equal to 0. And it's very easy to see. If you want, I can explain you at the end, or you can just take it as a statement from the representation theory of the conformal group, that when you have two scalars, they can only couple to a symmetric traceless tensor. Okay? So the only three-point function between scalar, here you must have either a scalar or a symmetric traceless tensor. This is again follows from conformal symmetry, and the form of this three-point function is fixed by conformal symmetry. Okay? Is it okay? So the conformal block, which is the derivative, just acting on derivative on the three-point function, even if we had spin, nothing would change in our derivation. All we have to do is, instead of plugging here the expression for the three-point function that we did, we would plug here the expression for the three-point function with spin that we also know. Okay? And that gives rise to a conformal block that is just a simple prefactor that depends on the positions times the interesting part, which is a function of the cross ratios. And that function, we saw that in principle we would have to resum all this mess and see what we get, and it's a product of hypergeometric functions. This cross ratio z and z bar, they have a nice geometrical interpretation. So let me remind you, again, follow me because this was a bit fast last time, that we can, whenever we have 4 points, by a conformal transformation, we can always put them in a plane. So how does it go? You have 4 points here. Make a translation so that one of them is at the origin. Now make an inversion. That guy is at infinity now. Now we will never do inversions again. So that point will stay at infinity. We will only do finite transformations. So we have 1 point at infinity. Now make a translation to put one of the three that stayed at finite values at the origin. Now we'll never do translations again. So the point at the origin and the one at infinity will continue there. Now make a rotation so that one of the 2 points becomes on the x-axis. So now we have a point at 0, a point at the x-axis, a point at infinity, and a point somewhere else. Now make a dilatation so that the point at the x-axis is at 1. So now we have a point at 0, a point at 1, a point at infinity, and a point somewhere else. Now make a rotation along this x-axis so that the point somewhere else is in the plane xy. Okay? So by a sequence of just simple conformal transformations, we can always put 3 points at 0, 1, infinity, and at some coordinate x, y. And then we can define, so this is equivalent to the cross ratio, and indeed we could write z, which is x plus I, y, and z bar, which is the complex conjugate. And this z and z bar, the product of them can be written as a nice cross ratio, and the product of 1 minus z times 1 minus z bar as well. And then Andrew pointed out, absolutely right, that in general we think in terms of one cross ratio, but of course it's perfectly compatible. We can think in terms of either one complex cross ratio, if we know z, of course z bar is just a complex conjugate of it, or in terms of two real coordinates. If I want to specify the position of a point, I need two coordinates, or a complex number. Everything is perfectly fine. Now, this is not the modern way of finding conformal blocks. Dolan and Osborne actually found the first conformal blocks really doing this. I mean, in principle, these B's are fixed by conformal symmetry, and they really managed to resum this function and to get this nice hypergeometric. But that's not the modern way of thinking about it. In the same way that we think of the spherical harmonics as the operators that have good quantum numbers according to rotations, that is, acting on the Casimir of rotations, we get jj plus 1, right? Which tells you that it has definite angular momenta. The way to properly derive this conformal box, let me just tell you for, is by thinking in very analogous terms, in terms of the Casimir of the conformal group. So let me just briefly tell you, my plan is that this should not take me more than 5 minutes. Let's hope it's true. Otherwise, we'll have to go. So, the Casimir of the conformal group is just some quadratic Casimir, something built of this operator, say, for example. Not for example, this is what it is. And you can check that this guy is a Casimir. It commutes with the generator. Okay, so it's the analog of J square when you have angular momenta. So now you have the dilatation square, you have a quadratic form with special conformal and translations, and you have the rotation. Okay? In the same way that j square acts on an operator with definite spin to give jj plus 1, the Casimir square acts on an operator on a primary of definite delta and del to give the Casimir, which is this, it's the generalization of jj plus 1, times the primary of delta and del. Okay? So this is just representation theory of the conformal group. And I'm using this notation with states already, more or less implicitly reminding you that we can have this operator map, operator state correspondence. Now, if you have these guys, they are differential operators, right? I mean, each of these operators is a differential operator, like x dx for dilatations, x mu d nu minus d nu x mu for rotations, and so on. If you take all these generators, J1 plus J2 plus J3 plus J4, where by this 4 I mean it acts on X4. So the generator that acts on point 1, 2, 3, or 4. And they act on the correlation function, O1 up to O4, what do we get? 0, that's the definition of a theory being conformal invariant. If we transform all the points, we don't change the result. And similarly, of course, that those C's don't matter, so for this argument, so if I act with them on, say, the conformal block, also, I also get 0. So this is just a consequence, a statement that we have conformal invariant. So if I have some amplitude in quantum mechanics of some process and I just rotate the full system, I get the same amplitude. So let's consider something, however, which is more natural. We have, say, the points 3 and 4, and we want to see what is entering or leaving, it's irrelevant, these 2 points and going to the other 2 points. So we want to understand these two different groups and to have a base of functions that flows from the group 1, 2 to the group 3, 4. That's what that formula gives us. So let's consider the following object. Let's consider, inspired by this picture, and this is exactly what we do when we do a partial wave decomposition in quantum mechanics, let's consider acting with the Casimir, the partial Casimir, this is how Dolan and Osborne call it, that is a sum of J1 plus J3 squared. So it's a Casimir just considering these two points here. One second. And let's act with this Casimir on the conformal block, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yes. No, these J's, they are the generators. They are all possible generators of the conformal group. For example, these G's can be this. Or this G can be M. Or this G can be K. Take any of these generators. So J is equal dilatations, or K, or P, or M. There are like 16 of them. Right, that's right. OK, let me put an index. A. Very good. Yeah? And the Casimir is like JA, JA. Yes? Conformal invariant. What is the statement, for example, when you have a theory that is translation invariant? It's the statement that if you translate all points, you get the same result. So it's killed by total translation. Yes. So if it's killed by the generator of the conformal group, it's the definition of having conformal invariance. Exactly in the same way that if I have a function, I translate all points, I get zero. So it's killed by translations in a general theory. So let's act with J3 plus J4 square, so the Casimir, on the conformal block. So what do we act? We get that J3 plus J4, which are differential operators, square, with these generators acting here. Let me indicate what I mean. I mean that these generators that are differential operators on 3 and 4, they come through this expression, and they will sit here. So let's denote this by this. Right? So the generators, you act with the generators, and they are now here. OK? It's OK? Good. Now they are there. However, but on the other hand, if we consider G3 plus J4 plus J1, or any index, actually, acting on the three-point function that is there, delta L at x1, O3 at x3, O4 at x4, again, by conformal invariance, this is 0. Right? So at this point, this is equal. We can very well replace this. We can add and subtract J1. So this is equal to J1 square acting there, right? I can't, because the sum gives 0. But J1 square acting on the three-point function, it just acts on one operator. And we know that the action of the Casimir on a single, on something of definite delta and so on, gives this. So it is just equal to delta minus D plus L plus D minus 2 times the three-point function. So now we compare both. On the one hand, we have these guys, which are some differential operator, right? And some differential operator acting on the conformal block must give a number times the conformal block. Right? Is it clear? So in this way, what we derive is that, so we obtain that differential operator acting on the conformal block is equal to a constant that depends on delta and del, which is that constant over there, or this one here, times the conformal block. Yes? Right.
Okay, and when we take a square of this operator and let's say that like square of sum of junior to zero, but don't have cross terms, then
no. So you have J3 plus J4. So you don't, no? You have J3 plus J4, A, times J3 plus J4, right? This is what you have, acting on the operator. Now, add and subtract here J1. Right? Now all this stuff is zero, so we only have J1. Right, so this is equal. Now this J1, of course, commutes with this generator, it acts on different points. Now, and now do the same thing. So we conclude that we have we just derived a differential equation.
Some differential operator which acts on point 2 and 3, acting on f is equal to a constant times f. So if we write f as our prefactor that we know must be there by conformal symmetry times g, we can take the differential operator through the prefactor and find a differential, differential equation for this g. So for g, this equation becomes, we have some differential operator acting on g of delta l equal to this c delta l times the function again. And this differential operator, so that I can just give you a flavor of how it looks like, it's something like this. It contains terms, let me write three terms of this differential operator so that you can have a feeling of how it looks like. Something like z square, 1 minus z square, d square, dz square plus, let me write a different term. For example, there is one which is like this. Delta 1 minus delta 2 times delta 3 minus delta 4, everything over 4, times z plus z bar plus, tak, tak, tak. There are like seven terms like this. Some differential operator, some not. So you see that you get a partial differential equation on z and z bar. And the solution to this partial differential equation with boundary conditions fixed by the requirement that we have a good operator product expansion limit is what gives precisely the hypergeometric functions that we derive, that we could derive in this more brute force way. So that's the modern way of doing things. Okay? Is it clear? Yes? No? Maybe?
I don't understand how we got from J1 acting on the place where the hash is, on the Friedmann Borel function, to J1 acting on the whole expression, because there is also x1 dependence in front of the Friedmann Borel function.
Absolutely true. Very good point. What happens at J1 acts on the three-point function and gives a number.
Now that it gave a number I can put here. Yes? So J1, it acts here, and it gives just a number. Now this number I take out, right? So the important point, as exactly as you are saying, is that J3 plus J4, they have no problem going there. Then you convert into J1, but you are already here. Then J1 gives a number, and now a number can get out again. So in this way, you derive a differential equation that when you plug the ansatz, get some simple differential operator that you can plug in mathematics and get some hypergeometric function. And literally, you can do it. And then you get more than one solution, and you fix the ones by having a good operator product expansion limit. Very good. And you see that the dimension enters through the eigenvalue of J squared. Also, to answer, for example, your question yesterday. Okay, very good. So let me then just remind you that some open problems, which are that, for example, the conformal blocks, these are called conformal blocks, for three dimensions, but actually for any odd dimensions, are not known. It's not, and you do have a differential equation. This differential equation is perfect, but no one knows how to solve it. So this is the state of the art. And actually, you could ask, and what about, by the way, considering four-point functions, not of scalars, but four-point functions, where in the external guys, I also put tensors. Suppose I want to compute something like correlation function of force energy tensors, force stress energy tensors, right? then it's not true that if O1 and O2, if they are tensors, that the only representation I can have flowing is symmetric traceless. So if this O1 and O2 are tensors, then here I could have very generic tensors with mixed representations and so on. So conformal blocks with spin are not known. In principle, there is a class of them that is was discovered last year, that was studied last year by Panedonis, Costa, Ryshkov, and Poland, just last year, of conformal blocks with spin. And those are the following kind of conformal blocks. Imagine you have tensors on the outside, but they are such, they couple in such a way that still what flows is only symmetric traceless. That's a restriction. Then you can compute that contribution. So that's the conformal blocks for the exchange of symmetric traceless with external spin. But if what flows is more than symmetric traceless, a new idea is needed because it becomes very messy, all this computation, and no one knows exactly what's the best way to address. Or people know that there is a beautiful formalism called the embedding formalism, but there hasn't been much progress yet. But okay, maybe in June, as I said, there will be a conference on all this stuff. Maybe there will be some progress then. Now, let's move. So this took me a bit longer than I thought. Let's move to Ante de Sitter. And I prepared some pages. I don't know if all of you have them with you now, because some of you arrived a bit after. If you don't, take one with some pictures, because those pictures, they are here. So maybe you can pass them to the back in case someone doesn't have them. So these are pictures that you all saw in the tutorial. But since I think they are a bit too hard for me to draw them, I decided to print them in case my pictures start to become miserable. But let's see. Maybe it's not so bad. It will not be so bad. So let me just remind you of the results of the tutorial. And you tell me if you have any question about it. We've considered in the tutorial the following, the space, which is an hyperboloid. Given by the condition that y0 square, or y, we start counting at minus 1, y minus 1 square plus y0 square minus y1 square minus dot 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 minus yd minus 1 square was equal to 1. Okay? So you see that in this case, this would be x0, this would be x minus 1, and this would be, y0, this would be y minus 1, and this will be the other y's. Okay? And you see that this y0 and y1, the square of them is a circle, that when the other y's are 0, is a circle of it's a unit circle, so it's this circle here. And when these y's are bigger than 0, you put them on the other side, so you get bigger and bigger circles as you go there, and this gives this picture of an hyperbola. Yeah? So we saw that this is also a nice representation of Ante de Sitter, of ADS D, I hope. I mean, for some reason I put this D, but then I forgot to write ADS D. Let's see. If we have 5, ADS 5, let's see, minus 1. So 1, 2, and then 5. If it's 5 here, there will be 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's okay. Yeah. So this would be a representation of ADS D. How do we see the connection between this and say the Poincaré ADS in Poincaré coordinates? Where we had a metric ds square, which was dz square plus dx mu, dx mu over z square. So the picture that we would draw in that case is considerably different. We would have something like that. As z goes up, you have different copies which are smaller and smaller of Minkowski space. What's the relation between these two? Well, it's easy to see. Here, we consider a space, so it's an hyperboloid, which is embedded in R2, D minus 1. So you have two time directions and six space directions, and D minus 1 space directions. And the metric is just ds square, is just the usual flat metric, dy dot dy, subject to the constraint such that y square equal to 1 in this sense. So we plug a parameterization and we compute dy dy to see what the metric becomes, the induced metric. And the parameterization that shows that these two are the same is the one where we say that y minus 1 plus y d minus 1 is 1 over z, while y mu is x mu over z. For mu, for the mu's here. For mu equals 0 up to d minus 2. So you see, for d equal 5, we get from 0 to 3. Notice that I'm not giving you the condition for x minus 1 minus x y d minus 1, because that you can read from the constraint. Right? So I'm giving you only the necessary number of conditions. Now, you see that if you do this, then this hyperbola becomes this Poincaré. But you also see that actually the Poincaré space can be put inside the hyperboloid, and the hyperboloid is more than Poincaré. Because you see that, for example, this y minus 1 plus yd minus 1 is positive. So Poincaré covers only a subspace of this y, the one where the sum of these two coordinates are positive. And this is represented in the first picture that you have. Can I also have a nice color picture? I only have black and white. Who has the pictures? So this is this picture. Like this, so it's the first one, where you see that you have this orange part, and the orange part is the part where this diagonal, which is y minus 1 plus yd, is positive. Okay? So we see that we cover only like half of this hyperbola. Okay, so I think I will not even attempt to draw. Of course, I would fail. I mean, you can imagine, right? This is hard to draw. Very good. Now, so we understand that in this, ADS in Poincaré coordinates is related to ADS in so-called embedding coordinates. And the relation is that the embedding contain a bit more than the ones in Poincaré. Poincaré, the embedding is a bit bigger. Now, there is another very, very useful parameterization of this under the Sitter spacetime, which is the one which is called global ADS. Global ADS is the parameterization where you say that y minus 1 plus iy0. So you parameterize, you see, you put these two in the plane. So you parameterize these circles here. And you say that these circles are some radius, cos rho. You see, the rho is 0 here. And here, rho is positive. So the radius, this will be the radius. And then the angle, which we call e to the I t. And then the other ones, y, I, where this I was run from 1 up to d minus 1. So note an important difference. Here we have an important difference, not so important, but it's a difference. Mu here was from 0 to d minus 2. And here we were using one time coordinate and one space coordinate to build ADS. Here we are using the two time coordinates, and all the remaining one are space directions. Right? It's why this I is not the same as the mu there. And that one we can parameterize as sinh of rho. So that the square of this guy minus the square of this guy gives 1 times a unit vector. So this parameterizes a unit vector, which gives a sphere of d minus 2 dimensions. Now, if you plug these coordinates to see what the space-time looks like, you see that in this case, ds square is minus cos square of rho dt square plus d rho square plus sinh square of rho, and then a metric of a d minus 2 sphere. And this space-time, as you saw, we can plot, we can represent them, we can represent it. Its Penrose diagram is the following. We can plot time as going up. This direction here would be rho. And then for a fixed time and rho, we have a sphere. So lines here, for example, this one here. As before, when we were discussing yesterday, radial quantization represents a sphere SD minus 2, whose radius depends of how inside or outside I put this S. So these guys will be spheres of different radius. Here we only see an S1, but we have to use our imagination to see more. Now, from this picture, ADS, we see something important. ADS is also like a box. We have time, we have rho, and this picture where we use the Penrose diagram to bring infinity to a finite distance is actually a very good thing to do, because the physics is actually such that if you send particles moving in ADS, what particles do, say geodesics, is that they stay inside ADS. So this would be some geodesic. And they move inside this cylinder going back and forth. So enter the Sitter space is a gravitational box. So if we send massive particles, if we consider massive particles or strings, this could be a string, what it will do is it will move in the middle of this enter the Sitter space. Now, any question here? This was all in the tutorial. Okay. So, what about these guys? Do they cover the full hyperbola? Well, yes, they do. It's easy to see that they do. I mean, we have any time t, so we wrap any time that we want around this hyperbola. But notice also that naively, or not naively, I mean, if we think from the point of view of the hyperboloid, t should be identified with t plus 2 pi, because it's just an angle around this hyperboloid. But that's somehow bad. Why? Because, I mean, this would mean that you would evolve in time. In this cylinder, you start here, and then you come back, and you identify, and you come back before you started. You have closed time-like curves. So, of course, you don't want to identify. You want this cylinder to go on forever. Okay? That's clear? But that's fine. Okay, if you don't want to identify, don't. But what then does it mean from the point of view of the hyperboloid, if I don't want to identify? It means that as I go around the hyperboloid, I should think that I wrap this hyperboloid several times with some paper. And when I go around, I end up always on different sheets. So I'm going around, 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 and I wrapped it several times. And this is the second picture that you have, where you think of this hyperboloid in this universal covering language. Okay? So you should think of the hyperboloid that you go around in T, but you are not at the same position. You are somewhere else. Is it clear from the picture that you have? Okay. Now, notice something important. The boundary, let's see what is the boundary of global ADS. So when rho goes to infinity, so when we go to the boundary, ds square goes to e to the 2 rho from the cos square and the sinh square, and then minus dt square, so we put some rho to be some fixed very large value, minus dt square plus d omega s d minus 2. Right? So go to some very large and constant rho, right? Then d rho is 0 because rho is constant, and you end up with this matrix. This is the boundary. So what's the metric? What's the boundary? It's dt squared plus a sphere, right? Is it clear? So the boundary is R times a sphere. So the boundary of global ADS is R times a sphere, d minus 2. For n equals 4, d is equal to 5. And then we end up with n equals 4 on R times S3. So what I want to say is that we have this global space, and the gauge theory that lives on the boundary of this global ADS that covers more than Poincaré coordinates, because Poincaré coordinates fill part of the hyperboloid, and these guys fill the hyperboloid infinitely many times. So this part, that's why it's called global, it's more than just Poincaré, is not Minkowski, but it's R times S3. Whereas the boundary of Poincaré, the boundary here, the boundary of this Poincaré was just Minkowski, Okay? So what's going on? What's going on is depicted in the last figure, which I will try to draw. So let's draw the cylinder. This one is a bit trickier, but this one is an important picture. First, and now what happens is the following. If you try to see what is this boundary here, what is this boundary here that was Minkowski? And let's try to draw this boundary following the change of variables on the boundary of that cylinder. Okay? So you follow the change of variables, all the ones you go, say, if you want from Poincaré to embedding, from embedding to global, and see what it plots here. It plots into the following. It's very simple to imagine what you do. Pick a napkin, which is a square, and wrap the napkin around the cylinder so that the two endpoints of the napkin touch. So now I'll try to draw this. And I will probably fail, but let's see. So the napkin is here, it will wrap, and then it will go here, and it will go on the other side. So you understand the picture? So I'm putting a napkin and put it around here. So this is what's represented in the figure here. You have the red shape, the end, you put this napkin and you put it around. So this napkin, once you unfold, if you unfold, you end up with just the usual Penrose diagram for flat space. So you are putting the Penrose diagram of flat space on the Penrose diagram of global ADS. It occupies only part of the boundary of global ADS. Is it clear? So what you can do is the following. You can pick this napkin here and put many other, well, this is basically impossible for me to draw. You can, but you can imagine in this picture that you can now put many other so-called, this is what's called a Poincaré patch. It covers only a patch. You can put many others on top and many others in the bottom. Is it clear? Yes? Is it clear? Just put this picture, now flip, put here, 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 put many above and put many below. Right? So we can put up here on this boundary, we can put an infinite tower of copies of Minkowski space in the boundary, which we can call Z to the N Minkowski of Minkowski space, four dimensional, where N is bigger than zero. And down here, we can stack an infinite tower, Z to the power minus N of four dimensional Minkowski with N smaller than zero. Okay? So what you have is the following. You have a conformal field theory that lives in Minkowski space. And now we are seeing that there is a natural way of putting together many Minkowski spaces and putting a tower of Minkowski spaces on top of this one. So we put a tower. The next one would be, so this would be one. These two lines are identified. This would be the next one, n equal to 1. Here, n equal minus 1. here n equal 2, and so on. You see? You can put, if you unfold the cylinder, you can put all these infinite towers of Minkowski space. Then you can ask this question. Is it possible in a CFT, can a CFT be analytically continued to this tower of Minkowski spaces? Can I define in a CFT correlation functions where I put 2 points in one Minkowski and 1 point in another Minkowski and another point in another Minkowski? Right, you see? Is a CFT well defined not only in Minkowski, but can it be analytically continued to the full tower, which we know is equivalent to R times S3? And there is a paper that addresses precisely this question by Mack and Lusher, and what they said is yes. The answer is true. Indeed, a conformal field theory can be naturally analytically continued to this full tower of Minkowski spaces. They have a very nice name for this one. They call these ones above, they call them the spheres of heaven. Am I writing this properly? Evan? Is Evan like this? Evan? Evan? No? How is it? Sorry? H? Ah, yes. That makes more sense. You have some spheres of Evan, and this one, can someone guess how they call the lower Minkowski ones? Sorry? Not spheres of hell, no, but of hell is correct, yeah? But they call it something nice, more artistic. Slightly, I think.
Circles.
Very good. Circles of hell. So they call this the spheres of heaven and the circles of hell. And Mark and Lusher show that you can analytically continue a CFT into the circles of heaven and the spheres of hell, or vice versa. So now, okay. So in particular, what I want to conclude from this discussion is that strings in global ADS, so in this gravitational box, strings in this gravitational box are dual to n equals 4 in R times S3, which we know we can think of this R times S3 as all this analytic continuation of the spheres of L, if we want, or if we want, we just think of it as R times a sphere. That's fine. In the same way that before, the one that came from the more brainy derivation, strings in Poincaré ADS, which are also perfectly fine, are dual to n equals 4 in Minkowski. And the two are related by an analytic continuation in the same way that conformal theories in different spaces are often related by Weyl transformations. Okay, now, let's explore an obvious consequence of this. Time here goes like this. This is time. And at the boundary, this is time. At the same time, the time in global ADS is the same time in the boundary. It's the time of R times SD minus 2. Is it clear? So then let's write this obvious statement. Let's write this obvious statement. That t in the bulk is equal to t in the boundary. And it's even the same letter. Of course, it is the same. So the time in the inside of the cylinder is the same time as in the outside of the cylinder. So this has some obvious consequence, which is that I actually wanted to write the both in reverse, but okay. It has the obvious consequence that energies of strings inside the cylinder, or in global ADS, are equal to energies of n equals 4, of the states in n equals 4 in R times S3. Just they are conjugated to exactly the same time. But we had already encountered this guy yesterday, and we showed that energies of a conformal field theory in R times S3, this was what we did yesterday, was nothing but the anomalous dimensions of n equals 4 on R4. Okay? So the conclusion, let me just write, because this is the main conclusion. So the main conclusion of today, or the first main conclusion of today, is that this very important observable in n equals 4 super Young Mills is equal to the energies of strings in global ADS. So up to now, the computations we were doing in entity sitter space were minimal surfaces ending on boundaries in Poincaré ADS. Now we steer gears. Now we see, what do we want to study? We want to put strings moving in this bound, in this bulk, strings that are pulsating and moving and propagating forever in the bulk, and we want to study their energy. Well, now it's another different classical problem, for example. To study these anomalous dimensions at large lambda, what we want to do is study classical strings moving in the middle of this gravitational box. Okay? We'll put stuff there, put strings, some strings rotating and moving, and we'll compute their energy and match with gauge theory. So it's now a slightly different paradigm. Very good. Yes?
Yeah, so my question is, like, why would we be interested in calculating, for example, correlation function between two Poincaré patches, like on the global ADS? What is the motivation to study something like that?
Well, maybe put that way, maybe not much indeed, but you should keep in mind that that analytic continuation that has some fancy name as analytic continuation, blah, blah, it has also another name. It is just R times S3. So R times S3, you put you are putting your theory in a box. That's something very physical to do. And that's something you might want to do, compute correlation functions of a gauge theory where you have where space-time is R times S3. Or even more naturally, what kind of questions do you really immediately want to ask when you put a theory in a compact space? What's the spectrum? Right? So when you put the gauge theory on R times S3, you are right. The most natural things to ask is not correlation functions. The most natural thing to ask are energies. But that's exactly what I'm saying here. The energies from this global ADS point of view are the energies of n equals 4 in R times S3. These indeed are the things that come to mind. You put the gauge theory in a box, compute the energy spectrum of the gauge theory. That's the most natural thing to compute after putting the theory in a box. But on the other hand, yes, today we saw that energies of a conformal field theory in this particular box are equal to anomalous dimensions on R4. So now it depends. I mean, I like both. I mean, from this point of view of this motivation, we like this one more because we want to say study all correlation functions. So we are particularly interested in this interpretation that we want to compute the two-point functions of the theory. But the two-point functions of the theory are not more physical than the energies of the theory in the sphere. Both are very nice quantities. They are the same. Okay?
How does this equality hold in terms of, what is the formula for this equality? Because you don't have any dimension there.
For delta equal energies?
Yeah.
Right, so the energies, remember that when we write a string action, We are already working with totally dimensionless stuff. So we have a truth coupling times ADS with radius 1 and sphere with radius 1. Right? So the claim is that really these deltas, they are of course functions of the truth coupling lambda. These energies are of course functions of the truth coupling lambda. The deltas are easy to compute at weak coupling. The energies of strings are easy to compute at strong coupling, as usual. So then, our goal is to understand, of course, our really ultimate goal is to plot them, is to plot what is delta as function of lambda. And we know the usual story here will be very easy or easy to do using strings. Here it will be easy to do using the gauge theory. And the challenge is, of course, as usual, to study the interpolation. Same is true for the three-point functions. C1 to 3, they will also be functions of lambda. And in principle, string will be easy, gauge theory will be easy, or more or less easy. And then the hard part, as usual, is how do we go about, with these important hints of knowing the beginning and the end, computing the real function. So right now, in the remaining part of all these lectures, ADS for us, in the same way that ADS for us in the first part of the lectures was a synonym for ADS in Poincaré coordinates, from now on, whenever I mention ADS, I have in mind this gravitational box. So now, or the embedding, I will sometimes alternate a bit, but we will not discuss Poincaré until the very, very end of the lecture. So right now, we think about putting stuff on this gravitational box or on this hyperboloid that wraps many times. So it's, I mean, they really are one-to-one, right? So this cylinder that wraps many times here is equivalent to this hyperboloid wrapped many times. So I will use those two descriptions, which are equivalent, but I won't be discussing Poincaré. For this point of view of computing energies, it's not the most useful one. Any question? Yes.
And the dimensions of the operators on the flat space.
Yes.
That's true without any reference to ADS CFT.
Right? That's right. So the second equal sign doesn't use ADS CFT. The first equal sign uses ADS CFT.
Okay.
So the first equal sign tells that ADS CFT is an Hamiltonian duality. The time in the boundary is the time in the ball. The Hamiltonian in the boundary is the Hamiltonian in the ball.
Yes, but the energies are dimensional. The dimensions of operators are not dimensional.
No, the energies of strings are also dimensionless.
In any CFT? Even if it's not dual to any string theory?
No, you see, I mean, what are deltas? Deltas are the numbers that appear in the exponent in exponents.
Yeah.
They are dimensionless. They are numbers. They are like 2 plus lambda over pi plus whatever.
Okay, but the energies in the middle, like in the middle of the equalities, they are the dimensional form. They are called any CFT.
Here?
Yeah.
They are measured in units of radius.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
Could you please repeat what you want to say with the T involved T in the boundary?
Right. So you agree that you see that the T that is here, this time, so you have strings that move. They are moving in row. So you will have some string that will have some row. That will depend on sigma and tau, some t that depends on sigma and tau, and some part in the sphere. Let's call it some angle phi that depends on sigma and tau, right? And you have the string that moves in this box. And this t, translations in t, is a symmetry. It's an isometry, the Killing vector of this metric, right? So you can compute what are the energies of this string with respect to translations in t. What's the another charge associated to translations in t? That's what you call energy of the string. What I'm saying is that this T is exactly the same T that you find there. When you take the limit when rho is very large, that T is that T. I did not rescale that T or anything. So the time that measures energies in the boundary, which is that T, is also the time that we define as measuring energies of the string, which is called global time. So the ADS global time is the time of the boundary. So the energies conjugated to that time are the same. Okay? So this is, it can be summarized by saying ADS-CFT is an Hamiltonian duality. Okay, very good. So in the remaining minutes that we have, let's study at least the energies of one solution. Let's compute, just so that this is not totally abstract, let's compute the energies of a single solution. So let's try. To study the energy of the simplest possible solution. So the simplest solution, let's go back to this hyperboloid feature. So it will be some string moving on the hyperboloid times the sphere. Okay? The sphere we never touched in the above discussion, but it's moving somewhere in the hyperboloid and in the sphere. Now let's go for a bit to flat space. What is the simplest string solution that you know in flat space? Sorry?
Oscillating is too complicated.
Static.
No, static. What do you mean by static? A static string is not a solution. A string
okay.
is not static.
So the one which was rotating around himself?
Right. So a string that is moving just as a point-like object, that it just wraps to a point, doesn't depend, it's not extended, and just moves like a point in space-time. Mm-hmm. That's the simplest solution. So let me write off the simplest solution in flat space. Is just x mu, that in principle could depend on sigma and tau, is just
moving with some momentum times tau, and there's nothing else. Normally, the general solution, you have plus what? What do you have here?
Vibrations.
Sorry? Vibrations. So here, you have the modes. Right? By these modes, I mean this alphas, exponential, and so on. You have the vibration part. So here we are considering the solution, the simplest solution in flat space, where we have no modes. No vibrational modes are excited. So now we want to consider the analog here. So what would be the analog of this solution? So let's try to take a point-like solution. So we have some geodesics. So what's the geodesic of a point-like particle in a sphere? It's a great circle. So point particles in the sphere, they move in just in great circles. So they have a point, and it just moves along this great circle. Okay? So let's write our guess for the solution, which would be in the sphere. So we have some coordinates, x1 squared plus x squared equal to 1. What number should I put here? Sorry?
Six.
It's a five sphere. Six. Equal to 1. And let's try this solution, which is like x1 plus I x2 is equal to e to the I. And let's call this j tau. And this is a very good number, a very good label, j, because it's some angular momenta going around. So this would be like our guess. Then what would be the simplest point-like particle moving in EDS? Well, the simplest point-like particle is just the one that in the same way as this goes around here, that just goes around this cylinder. So you pick a point-like particle, it moves around the cylinder several times, and it goes around the sphere several times. So here, what we would write is that y minus 1 plus I y0 is equal to e to the I. And then let me call it, okay, let me call it kappa for now times tau. So this would be our ansatz. And this guy, I want to call it curly. I want to put something curly. Okay. Just because there will be an uncurly one. So. Okay, so this is our guess. And now let's see if this would be what we would call the simplest solution. What is it doing in this language, which is somehow nicer to understand? What is the solution that just goes around that circle in EDS? What does it do in the gravitational box? Someone else that is not normally answering. What will the solution that is just going around that smallest circle in EDS do in this box? In the language of box. So let's write the analog. If it were in the picture of the box, what should I draw?
Straight line.
Sorry?
Straight line.
Exactly. It is just a particle that is just just standing still in the middle of ADS. Right? At rho equal to zero, just in the middle and evolving in time. So this is just the solution where, remember, this is time. So this is the solution t equal kappa tau, And if we define this to be e to the I phi, then, so this is the solution. T of sigma and tau is just kappa tau. And if we define this, this would be the solution where phi of sigma and tau is just curly J times tau. So this would be the description in global coordinates, this one, this and this. So this is global, and this one, this language here is embedding coordinates. Okay, so this would be what we would write in embedding and in global coordinates. So in global, we just have time evolves uniformly, and the angle evolves uniformly, and the way it evolves is related to the angular momentum. So now let's see, let's study this in slightly more detail. So first, I'm thinking, should I really do it or should we stop? What do you prefer? We could now just check that this obeys the equations of motion, write what's a string action and so on. Or we could stick to this simple picture and tomorrow continue from here. What do you prefer? Not tomorrow. Okay. Let me rephrase it. You prefer that I write down what the action is and we check that it goes through the equations of motion and study what's the energy and so on? Or do you want to think a bit about this picture and do you prefer that I stop here? Sorry? A show of hands, that sounds like a good idea. So can you raise your hand if you have an opinion? Good. What's your opinion? Okay. Does someone else have another opinion? To continue? Okay, let's continue a bit then. So what's the action? So let's write the action, the Polyakov action in already fixing a gauge in conformal gauge. So we are now not using Nambu-Goto. Let me just write what it is. And this is the action, the only action we will use. And this action is the following. We integrate d sigma d tau. Then we will use embedding coordinates. It's quite nice to use embedding coordinates. Then you have dAx dot dAx. So these are the sphere parts. Now, how do you impose that x is constrained to move on a sphere? How do you constrain that x squared is equal to 1? So this would be the flat space action, right? Just dx, dx. How do you impose that x squared is 1? Very good. What we can do is add a Lagrange multiplier. We add a field which is not dynamical. Let's call it lambda x, that is fixing the constraint x, times x dot x minus 1. You see that this x, the equations of motion for this field lambda, are just saying that x squared is equal to 1, right? In other words, you can think that when you are integrating, this is like e to the I lambda times this. You integrate over lambda. It's a delta function that sets x squared to be 1, OK? So two ways of thinking. Either you think that this is just a delta function, a functional delta function setting x squared to 1, or you think that the equations of motion for this field, which is not dynamical, and therefore you can impose the equations of motion, just tell you that x squared is equal to 1.
Question?
Yes?
Will lambda have any physical importance if you plug in the coordinate?
It will. We'll see. Lambda is important, very important. We'll keep this on. Now, what about the sphere? The sphere I never know by heart. It is the sign, so let's see. So we are using which signature? So we use the signature where space in the hyperbola has minus signs, right? Yeah? So then we want a minus. We want all the space coordinates to have the same signature, of course. So now minus the same thing for the sphere. And here the sign is irrelevant, but I can use minus. Okay, so this is the bosonic part of the action. Then there are, of course, Brenda will ask me if there are fermions. Indeed, plus fermions. Yeah, but we are studying classical solutions. We are studying the bosonic part.
Here, with the
internal
product, they are different for the two
things. That's right. So, yes. So, here, this dot product is that thing there. This is y dot y. And for x, x dot x is the usual Euclidean dot product, right? So, is it clear? Should I write what it is? It's clear, right? Yes? No? Should I? So, this is with signature. Plus, 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 plus. And you see this dot product is minus, minus, plus, 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 plus. Okay. So what are the equations of motion? Now to answer Andrew's question, let's. So this is the action. Let's start by the simplest thing that we have to impose. We want to study the motion of closed strings. Okay, and of course, same for y's. And we already, you remember how Polyakov works. You have Nambu-Goto. How do you go from Nambu-Goto to Polyakov? I don't know if this was the way you did. But one way of doing is you introduce a metric, a world sheet metric H. But nothing is depending on H. H is just a metric that chooses a parameterization. And then H is an undynamical field. And you have equations of motion for the metric that are just delta X and delta H equals 0. And they impose constraints. So if you write the action in Nambu-Goto form, everything is fine. And you don't need to worry about all this stuff. If you write it in Polyakov, you put a metric, but then you put a constraint which tells you that parameterizations are not important. So those give rise to what we call Virasoro constraints that we should fix, which in this case just tell you that d tau of y plus or minus d sigma of y dotted with the same thing, d tau of y plus or minus d sigma of y. I choose the same sign for both, of course. Now let me see, must be equal to the same thing with y replaced by x. So these are the Virasoro conditions that couple the two motions in the two space-times. And now let's do the most interesting one, just to answer the question of Andrew, to see what are the equations of motion, and we'll see that lambda is quite important. So can you tell me what are the equations of motion for x following from that action there? So you have Lagrange equations, right? D alpha of derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to dx alpha. Is it okay? What does that give? Very good. That gives x double dot, which is box, let's write, del a of x. Right? That comes from a derivative of Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of x. But then you have derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x itself. Right? And that gives lambda. So we get plus, I think, or minus, minus, lambda x times x is equal to 0. So these are the equations of motion. So these are equations of motion for x. What are, again, let me repeat, what are the equations of motion for lambda? They are just the sphere constraint that x squared is equal to 1. Okay? So the first time you see this, at least the first time I saw this, this looks a bit strange because it looks like we don't have enough equations. Right? And you get box x minus lambda x. How can I find? I don't know x or lambda. Right? This looks a bit weird. So what do you propose to do? How could these equations be good? They look a bit strange. I mean, the first equation, I have too many variables. Right? I have the x's and the lambda. But I have one equation for each component of the x, and it looks like I have more variables than equations. So how can we solve this? How can we find lambda? So one idea is to take the inner product of this equation with x. Then x squared is 1. So we find that lambda, so we dot this equation, x dotted with this equation, implies that lambda is equal to x dot the second derivative of x. By the second derivative, I mean this dA dA. This is not very useful. Now, this is OK. Now I can plug lambda here, and I solved my problem. But this is a bit nasty, because normally we don't like to have second derivatives in so many places. But actually, this is equal to minus dx dot dx. Can someone tell me why? Integration by parts is one way to say. In other words, x dot x equal 1, which implies if you take a derivative, that x dot dx equals 0, which implies if you take another derivative, that dx dot dx plus x dot d square x is equal to 0. Okay, so you can replace the second derivative by a first derivative squared. So the conclusion is that the equations of motion take the following nice form, which is box or del square of x plus dx dot dx times x are equal to 0. OK? So these are some very interesting set of equations. They are very hard to solve. They are nonlinear. And you see, you should compare with the kind of things that we are used when we do strings in flat space or some field theories for some free field, where typically we have something like box of the field plus mass times the field equal to 0, and then we do perturbation theory. And then it's very simple to start quantizing. You write x as a sum of modes, and you start doing usual canonical quantization. Here you see that the starting point is manifestly strongly coupled. I mean, it's manifestly non-local. There's no parameter. That by no means I can set this to 0. So even if you would like to start quantizing strings in this space-time, it's really a big challenge. So this is strong. I mean, this is one manifestation of the fact that we are dealing with a curved background or with a strongly coupled field theory. That makes it quite hard to quantize. OK, and the same way, we have the same equation for y. So now let's just to finish this, let's plug this solution in these equations and see what we get and see if it goes through or not. So if we plug that, so dx dot dx for that solution will be second derivative respect to sigma is 0, but derivative with respect to tau just gives j squared. OK? So if you do this, I mean, I'm not totally sure of the sign, but maybe it is correct. In the same way, if you compute for that solution dy dot dy, you get kappa squared. OK? Then you want to ask, do we have that d squared of x plus j square x equal to 0? Right? Yes or no? You see, x is just exponential. Take two derivatives, you get ij square. Indeed, it cancels precisely this. Yes? Now you see, now it became really of the usual kind. It's just a particle with a mass here, j square. So indeed, you take derivative of that x, you just bring down ij twice gives minus j squared, so this is perfectly true. And in the same way, immediately we see that it's also true that the equation for y is also equal to 0. So that's fine. So we found our first classical solution. What about the relation between J and K? Well, that comes from Virasoro. Virasoro, because the metric of the world sheet couples to both sphere and ADS, Virasoro is always the condition that tells that couples the both spacetimes. So it relates kappa and J. So Virasoro fixes kappa to be equal to J. Okay? So now we found everything about our solution. The only thing we have to answer is what is the physical meaning of these two letters, of kappa and J. And right now they are just two parameters. So what? Yes. So what's the physical meaning of kappa and J? Well, we can compute physical quantities, for example, the charges associated to the symmetries of my string sigma model, right? For example, what would you call energy? And what would you call angular momentum? One angular momentum, one of the angular momentums. Let's call it J1. So what would you call energy? Energy, for example, is the symmetry associated to rotations between x0, between y-1 and y0. Right? So the energy is what? It's square root lambda over 4 pi times the integral d sigma of the Noether charge associated to rotating these guys, which will be something like y0, y-1 dot, minus y-1, y0 dot. In other words, it will be nothing but square root lambda over 2 pi. I'm putting a 2 and a 4 by instinct. I don't know why I'm doing that. It might be correct or not. This one is correct. This one I'm not sure. And this is equal, this guy are just exponential of time, so this is equal to the integral of, with respect to d sigma, from 0 to 2 pi, as usual, of global time dot, derivative of global time with respect to tau. An angular momenta would be, of course, the charge related to rotating x1 and x2, so I write exactly the same expression, but with x1 and x2. And since x1 and x2 in global coordinates, they are related to this angle, another way of writing it in global coordinates is integral d sigma of phi dot. Right? Is it clear? So is this clear? By the way, do you see the factor of 2 that I wrote? Is it correct? Probably is. In other words, in any case, this one is certainly correct. This is the string tension. And translations and T is an isometry, so of course I should put there T dot. So that one I'm sure. So now we see what's the physical meaning. So T dot, T is just kappa tau. So T dot is kappa. You integrate, you get 2 pi. That cancels this 2 pi. So energy is equal to square root of lambda times this kappa. And angular momenta, J1, this charge associated to J1, is equal to square root of lambda times this curly J. And kappa and J are the same. So we conclude that the energy, which is equal to our delta, we conclude that our solution is a solution which has energy equal to J1. The energy is equal to its angular momenta. This is the way of describing this point-like string. So a point-like string that moves around the sphere, around one of the great circles of the sphere as a point, and is totally boring in anti-de Sitter, is a string where the energy is equal to the angular momentum. And tomorrow, we should look for the dual. There should be, as we know, a dual operator, O, and the dimension of the operator O should go to just J1, at least when lambda is much bigger than 1. Energy of a string is dual to a single trace operator, as we saw. So there should be a single trace operator such that the energy at strong coupling, at least, is nothing. The dimension of this operator is nothing but the angular momenta of that operator. Okay? So what hints could we have to try to identify what kind of operator we should have? Well, we know that we have J1 units of a single angular momenta. So we should identify in the gauge theory a symmetry which is like this, that also rotates a scalar to one of the scalars to the other scalar. Like this symmetry, like rotates the axes, the six axes among themselves. Now the axes are the duals to the phis. So there should be a field, a symmetry associated to the rotating scalar phi 1 to phi 2. Now consider a scalar that is charged with respect to this U1 symmetry. What is it? It's phi 1 plus I phi 2. So it should be a guy that has J1 phi 1s plus I phi 2s and nothing else. It only has angular momentum in one circle. So we can already know this operator should be trace of phi 1 plus I phi 2 to the power J1. It's the only thing it can actually be. Okay, but we will come back to this tomorrow. So tomorrow I'll start by maybe redoing some of the stuff that we did here. And we will now move to more interesting solutions. This was just the point like string. Now we move to more interesting solutions. And not tomorrow. And on Tuesday, we move to the gauge theory side. Yes?
Aren't phi the scalars?
Phi are the scalars, yes.
Yeah, then what does it mean to take a trace of it?
Trace of phi 1 plus I phi 2 to the power j.
Yeah, true.
You multiply many phi 1 plus I phi 2. Each phi 1 plus I phi 2 has one unit of this U1 charge that rotates phi 1 to phi 2.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right?
So you multiply J1 of them so that the total charge is J1. So this is the only operator that only has charge J1. If there was two angular momenta, if the string was moving in two different planes, you knew that I must have J1 of these guys, of this scale of phi 1 plus phi 2, and J2 of the other ones. Then there would be many ways of ordering them inside the trace. You could put all the first type of scalars first, then the second, and then it will be not trivial to identify. But in this case, because you only have one kind of charge, and there's only one kind of scalar with that rotation charge, there's no ambiguity in the identification. It must be that scalar to the power of the number of units of angular momentum. Okay?
When it's only one or an odd number, isn't the trick zero?
No. Why?
Because if the generators are in that join and they are eight here.
No. One is. Trace of if J was one, it would be.
Okay.
But no, otherwise not. Something like that is true for fermions because you use cyclicity, but also the fact that the anti-commute. Oh, I always forget, but trace of the same fermion, if it's the same fermion. Trace of the same fermion to a given power, and I always forget if it's odd or even.
Does the fact that delta equals J1, is it somehow related to some kind of extremality?
Okay, that's very good that you're asking all these questions. You are saving me a lot of time for next time. It's very good. Exactly. So when you have something like delta is equal to J1, we will see that you see, what is the dimension, the classical dimension of this operator? That you have a scalar and you have J1 scalars. What is the classical dimension? Of a scalar is dimension 1. J1 scalar is dimension J1. You just connect several propagators between the two-point function, right? And you can see a scalar is dimension 1. So these guys have dimension J1. So at weak coupling, this guy, when lambda goes to 0, also gets J1.
It's just a number scale.
So we see that at weak and strong coupling, we have exactly the same value. So could it be that the curve, of course, it could be that the curve does something funny in the middle. But I mean, it's natural to expect if you have exactly the same thing at weak and strong coupling that it's just constant everywhere. And indeed, it is, and it follows from supersymmetry from exactly an extremality condition. So this operator sits in a particular representation, and if you can choose by supersymmetry, that the dimension cannot move, because then it would send it to another representation. The states cannot change representation. So there is indeed, you can show, by using just supersymmetry and the algebra of supersymmetry on the gauge theory side, that this operator should have, indeed, energy J1 at any coupling. From that point of view, the interesting computation is the one we just did. Because now it's strong coupling, before doing the computation, it's not obvious that you would find just J1. So then the interesting computation then would be, okay, I have a solution that must move in string theory, must have just one kind of angular momenta, so it must be just a point moving around. And if ADS CFT is correct, because of the supersymmetry prediction that it must be J1 always, I must find that the energy of this classical solution must be exactly the angular momentum. And then you do and you see it is. Very good. Okay, that's very good. More questions, please. That. Okay, so next time we'll start putting the modes of the string and considering really, operators with structure now, more interesting operators.